Okay, we're in Matthew 15, and that brings us to a real critical showdown with Jesus and the Jewish leaders. In fact, this is going to go really through chapter 16 and verse 12. I don't think we'll get that far tonight, but the whole picture of Jesus dealing with the Jewish leaders, specifically in this section that we're looking at, is the Pharisees and the scribes. And this is going to be a real confrontation, and pretty well seals any deeper relationship that Jesus and the Pharisees and scribes are going to have. So that from this point on, you'll be able to see that they're pretty well going to be enemies. Jesus now gets really, really pretty plain with them, and they've challenged him and challenged him, and now he has really shows their true colors.
Is it fair to say these scribes are also Pharisees?
Yes, the scribes and Pharisees usually hung out together, and the scribes, of course, spent their time teaching the law and writing the law, and then the Pharisees spent their time trying to fulfill everything the scribes told them to do. And so that's the kind of thing. Remember, there's two major sects of the Jews, the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Might just remind you a little rundown on them. The Sadducees are the individuals who ran the temple and were in control of the temple. They were the more political group. They would connect with kings and rulers and wanted to fit into the culture and society around them, especially the political climate. They are the ones, when you read chief priests or high priest, that's Sadducees. The Sadducees would pride themselves on being the priestly lineage. So they came about, Pharisees and Sadducees, usually we historically believe they rose up somewhere around 160 BC, something like that, after the Antiochus Epiphanes persecution that took place during that time. And so these two sects came up that time. So anyway, the Sadducees, they had some unique beliefs in that they didn't accept the Old Testament except for the Torah, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, the first five books of the Old Testament, the only part they accepted. They didn't believe in a resurrection. They didn't believe in life after death. So you might say, well, why did they even believe in God? Well, because they believed if you believed in God, you would live a life of health and wealth. So they believed the same doctrine you hear some of these TV preachers preach. if you send them money, you'll get rich and live a wonderful life. And of course, they'll get richer. But that was the way the Sadducees looked at things. Pharisees would be at the opposite end of the scale, so to speak. They believed in the whole Old Testament. They believed in a resurrection. They believed in life after death, all of that. The problem with the Pharisees is that they added traditions and laws to the scriptures. They believed that not only did God reveal a written law to Moses and the prophets, but that God also revealed an oral law that God handed down from generation to generation. The word tradition that we're going to read about in this text literally means that which is handed down. So they're talking about Moses goes on the mountain, Moses gets the law, but then after that God told Moses all kinds of things, in their view, all kinds of things that Moses then orally transferred to the people, and then that just got orally passed down from generation to generation. Hello. Good to see you. So we're just introducing Matthew 15. So anyway, that the Pharisees, you would say, were the more stricter sect, and yet on the other hand, how strict is a group of followers of God who add in their own laws? So on one hand, you know, yeah, they were, they believed in all of the Old Testament, and they really tried to strictly follow the law, but they also just added in all kinds of their own laws, and as you're going to see in this text, Jesus was definitely not happy about that. All right? Any questions about Sadducees, Pharisees, scribes? Those are the individuals you keep seeing over and over again. There were a few other minor sects of the Jews, like zealots, who believed that you ought to overthrow the Roman Empire. One of Jesus' apostles was a zealot. I'm sure he gave up that view, but that was who he was. All right, so let's notice the text then. Matthew 15, verse 1. Then Pharisees and scribes came to Jesus from Jerusalem and said, "Why do your disciples break the tradition of the elders, for they do not wash their hands when they eat?" He answered them, "And why do you break the commandment of God for the sake of your tradition? For God commanded, 'Honor your father and your mother,' and 'Whoever reviles father or mother must surely die.' But you say, 'If anyone tells his father or mother, what you would have gained from me is given to God, he need not honor his father.' So for the sake of your tradition, you have made void the word of God. You hypocrites, well did Isaiah prophesy of you when he said, 'This people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men.'" Okay, when you look at that text, what are some of the things that you might read there that you would either think are certainly interesting to you, or maybe even more importantly, what parts of this text would you say, "I'm not sure I understand that. There's some questions I have about that." What part of that would you see?
Exactly what their tradition was he was talking about.
Yeah. First question is what is this washing hands tradition? What is that? That's a good question. Good. You want to say something, Rachel?
Well, it basically what she said, the traditions of the elders.
Okay,
it's
yeah.
The elders, it's not the traditions or the law of God.
Good. Good observation. Yeah, it's interesting they don't say, "Why do your disciples break the law of God?" That's not what they say. "Why do your disciples break the tradition of elders?" So that gives you an idea that they have elevated tradition of their elders, so to speak, to the same level as the law of God. And so that was obviously a serious problem. So as I mentioned before, these traditions are oral things that were handed down. And now you can see why they would have elevated it to the law of God. Because they believe God actually spoke it to Moses and then Moses just handed it down verbally. Of course, they're mistaken about that, but you know, you don't read that in the Old Testament where, okay, yeah, God told Moses all kinds of things that he didn't write down. In fact, the scripture says the opposite. It says Moses wrote it all down. So, you know, we have it. But they had followed this verbal oral law, okay? So the next question is, well, what was this tradition about washing hands? You know, us today, we might immediately think, well, I can't believe anybody would have dirty hands and eat food. You got all kinds of gunk on your hands. Actually, those of us who work on cars and things like that, we do that all the time. We don't think anything about it. It's a little grease with your hamburger is just fine. But that's not what they were thinking. So the Pharisees had expanded God's laws about cleanness and uncleanness. Not cleanness as far as germs are concerned, but what was pure before God. And so in their mind, If you went to the marketplace, for example, as a Jew, and you went there and you bought food and you rubbed shoulders with Gentiles and maybe defiled people in their mind, and now you have, you're unclean. And then you touch food, and that becomes unclean. And we're not talking about unclean viruses and bacteria or dirt. You're talking about unclean in the sight of God, that somehow you're not pure now before God. And so now you have these impure hands, and you touch food and put it in your mouth. Now that impurity goes in your stomach. Uh-oh. How are you going to cleanse that? You're doomed, you know. So you see how that kind of played out. So they had a fancy-dancy way that they had made up, a fancy-dancy way about how you cleanse your hands. So here's how you do it. You take water and you hold your hands up like this toward the sky, and you pour water over until it drips off your wrist, and you do it on the other side until it drips off your wrist. You slap your hands together and rub them like this, and then you turn them upside down and you pour it off until they dripped off your fingers on both sides, and voila, you're clean. No, you need soap. Had nothing to do with it. See? So the disciples, they just ate. Why would they do that? Because they knew, studying with Jesus, that didn't make any difference at all. It had anything to do with anything. In fact, they may have believed it before Jesus. You know, there wasn't a whole lot of people that bought into everything the Pharisees said. So that would may have been weird to them. All right, so you can see the accusation. Now Jesus turns around and he shows how they have elevated their tradition to the point that it actually contradicts the law of God. And so Jesus uses an example about how they don't honor their father and their mother. And it's a little difficult just reading the text to figure out exactly what they're doing, but here in Mark's account it's called Corban. And what they were doing was, if a Jew got mad at his mom or dad, or just didn't like him very well anymore, or knew that mom and dad were getting to a part in their life, they were going to be a drain on their resources to have to take care of them, they would go down to the temple and tell the priest, "I'm devoting all that I have to the temple. It's all devoted. I'm not giving it to you yet." Just devoting it. And then that Jew would continue to use it for the rest of his life. And when he died, it was all given to the temple. But in the meantime, it's devoted. And so when mom and dad got ill, and like we would have our parents today get ill and need to be cared for and might need convalescent care and whatever, and couldn't make a living anymore, they'd say, "Oh, Dad, I am so sorry. I devoted all that I have to the temple, so I can't help you." Isn't that a great way to get around it? And so as Jesus says, you have taken your tradition and made, notice the words there in verse 6, you have made void the word of God. So in other words, you've nullified the authority of God by your traditions. Think about it this way. How happy do you think God is when he gives us his laws and we decide that we ought to make some more? You know, as a lawgiver, How you feel about that? What do you think your people have done when you give the laws and then they decide they need to add to it and give more laws? If you're God, how are you feeling?
Your words weren't enough for them.
Okay, number one, you think I'm insufficient as God. I must be insufficient to do a very good job of making a law. Good, good. What else might come to mind if you're God and you gave the law and your people are adding more things to it?
Well,
making a law gives this authority. You have authority, you know, so you basically, they're undermining your authority. Yeah. They're not respecting you or not.
They're making you, you're making yourself equal to God by making your own laws. And so this is a dastardly thing to do. And it's really insulting to God to turn around and do that. And yet, does it still happen today? All the time. The religions nowadays even get together and vote on whether or not they're going to have this law or that law. Are you kidding me? Well, I think God already gave the law. I don't think we need to vote on it. This isn't a democracy. We have a kingship. He's the king. He gets to make the laws. There's just one of those things, as Jesus points out here, there's nothing worse than to make void the authority of God. And yet that's exactly what happens here.
Barons, you know, especially, they just created a loophole.
Yeah.
And it's a capital offense.
Yeah, that's right. They created a loophole so they don't even have to obey God. That's exactly right. And they turned around and notice what he calls them in verse 7? Hypocrites. So what's a hypocrite? Can you give me the actual definition of it?
Who pretends to be one thing, something that he's not.
Yeah, he's a play actor. He has become an actor. So we, you know, if we watch a movie or you see a TV show or whatever, and you get accustomed to this person playing this particular part. You watch that long enough, you kind of get to know him in that part, don't you? And pretty soon you think he's actually, that's the way he really is. You ever notice that? And then all of a sudden you see him on a talk show or something. He's nothing like that. In fact, he's a dirt clod. He is nothing like that good person he plays in that TV show.
He's a good hypocrite.
Yeah, that's a hypocrite. Okay? A hypocrite is somebody who play acts what they want you to see, but are actually, when you're not watching, an entirely different person. And that's exactly what they were. They were play acting serving God. They were play acting that I'm a follower of God. And that's all they were, because they went about making up their own religious rules. And as soon as you make up your own religious rules, guess what? You might as well take this book and just pitch it out in the mud, because you're not following it anymore. You're deciding to follow your own. And that's a huge problem. So what do you notice in just verse 8 and 9 that Jesus, this is a quotation from Isaiah, we'll look at it in a second. But just looking at the quotation, what do you notice that's important about what he says?
Lip service.
Yeah, good. Lip service. They say it.
They don't mean it.
They don't mean it.
Oh. Walk.
Yeah, they talk, but they don't walk. That's right. It's like, oh yeah, I believe in God. Oh yeah, I like people to say, oh yeah, I believe in Jesus. I'm a Christian. All that. And it comes to, well, do you obey him? Well, he didn't expect me to do that. What do you think it means to believe in God? That's the whole idea. What else do you notice in the text?
He calls it vain worship when they do that.
Yeah, what's the word vain mean?
Just emptiness or of no account.
Yeah, it's empty, useless worship. Now, what's that teach you about worship?
It's very important.
It's important.
We need to treat it with more respect.
You need to treat it with respect? Absolutely. What else does that teach you about worship?
You try to do it exactly like God says.
Okay. Need to do it the way God says. Exactly. Otherwise, if I change it, now I've made up my own. It's pretty funny to try to worship God and turn around and make up your own way to do it when he already told you how to do it.
The implication is it has to come from the heart too, and not just an outward.
Good.
Right. Good.
Right. We're not talking about just outward ritualistic things. We're talking about that which comes out of our true understanding and belief in God and sincerity and passion for God. That's exactly right.
Not all worship
is pleasing to God.
Exactly. Not all worship is pleasing to God. That we see from the very beginning, don't we? Cain and Abel both offered worship, and God rejected Cain's worship because he didn't do the worship the way God said to do it. Genesis chapter 4. So that's, I think that is way not understood today. People today think, well, as long as I'm worshiping, who cares how it was done? Oh, it matters a lot how it's done when I'm making up my own way of doing it. And that's a major
issue. I think it's like this word, when he says, in vain do they worship me, it's really kind of like, it's useless what they're doing, because exactly. It's just not, you know, they might as well quit doing it because it's not going to get them anything.
That's right. Not going to make any effect on God at all. That's exactly right. And notice how he describes that teaching as doctrines, the commandments of men. So, following what men say instead of what God says. Now, with that, I'd like you to see where that comes from, because the text Jesus quotes is quite interesting to see how the full text that Jesus quotes kind of part of a sentence there. So that's back in Isaiah chapter 29 and beginning at verse 11. In fact, I think we'll begin at verse 10. Isaiah 29, verse 10. All right, this is a situation where God is condemning Jews 700 years before Christ, who are exactly like the Jews during the time of Christ.
All right. Which
Isaiah 29. Yeah, and beginning at verse 10. And so what you're going to notice is the context, even though you're talking about a different generation, the Jews of Isaiah's day are exactly like the Jews of Jesus' day. And that's why Jesus says, well, the prophecy of Isaiah is being fulfilled in you because you're acting like them. But he gives a bigger picture of it. Verse 10, for the Lord has poured out upon you a spirit of deep sleep and has closed your eyes, the prophets, and covered your heads, the seers. The idea is that the people loved ignorance, and they loved, as you'll see later in the text, to do what they wanted to do. And so the prophets and the seers who would come and rebuke them, they just closed their eyes and their ears to them. And the more the prophets speak, the more they close their eyes and their ears. They wouldn't listen to them. So here's verse 11 is a little humor from God. And the vision of all this has become to you like the words of a book that is sealed. Okay, so let's just stop right there. What in Isaiah's day would a sealed book look like?
A scroll?
Number one, it would be a scroll. That's exactly right. They didn't have books like we have here. That's kind of accommodatively put there in our text because we understand books and not scrolls. So it'd be a scroll. And how was a scroll sealed? Yeah, you just put some wax on it and roll it up and put some hot wax on it and then dry and, of course, seal it up. And so how hard would a seal be to break? Not hard at all, right? It was sealed mainly because it kept it all together. And when you wanted to read it, you'd break the seal. Okay, so let's notice this. Going on to verse 11. When men give it to one who can read, saying, read this, he says, I cannot, for it is sealed. Sound like a real big excuse? Oh, I can't read that. It's sealed. I mean, what would I do? I'd have to open that seal. I don't know. That'd be really tough. I don't guess I can read it.
That's like getting a letter in the mail.
Yeah, you set it down. You're sending all this mail. You go over and visit it. Yeah, that's good. You go over and visit a person. You go, how come you haven't opened the mail? I'd have to unseal it. You know? That would really be an effort, and I don't really want to do that. I mean, I do that with junk mail. because I don't want to read it. Guess what? Same thing. Why are they treating the scroll of God's word like junk mail? I don't want to read it.
Kind of like a guy I used to work with. He said if he didn't read the email, he wasn't responsible for it.
There you go. Simple as that. Boy, don't you like to work with somebody like that? Okay, and then the second one, verse 12. And when they give the book to one who cannot read, saying, read this, he says, I cannot read. Look, most people in those days couldn't read. How did you get your message? You found somebody who could read it to you. Wasn't a big effort. If you wanted to know the message, you could find the message. And what God says is, that's the way you people are. You don't really want the message. You're really not interested in the message. And so that's the kind of person you are. You're like a guy who won't even break a seal, who won't even open an envelope. That's your problem. There's no real seeking. So verse 13, he says, and the Lord said, because this people draw near me with their mouth and honor me with their lips, while their hearts are far from me, and their fear of me is a commandment taught by men. Okay, so that's what Jesus quotes. Their respect for God only comes from commandments taught by humans. So guess what? That's not respect for God, is it? He says that's the kind of respect that they have for me, is all they care about. They just listen to what they want to hear. The false prophets in those days, not people like Isaiah, of course, but the false prophets, how did the false prophets make money?
Tell them what they
wanted
to hear.
They tell them what they wanted to hear. That's exactly right. Just like a lot of the false preachers that you see today. They're going to make money if they tell the people what they want to hear. And they're not going to make money and if they don't tell them what they want to hear. So there you see that picture. And though God goes on to say, last verse, verse 14, therefore, behold, I will again do wonderful things with this people, with wonder upon wonder. That's going to refer to what Jesus does in the cross. And the wisdom of their wise men shall perish, and the discernment of their discerning men shall be hidden. In other words, I'm going to make it so that those false teachers are all a waste, and all the people who have followed them are going to be dismayed, because I'm going to show wonders to prove what's really right. So that's what Jesus is referring to back here, and back over in Matthew, how these people cared more about what they wanted to do and disregarded God and His Word, and that's why they changed it. So that's a very easy thing to do for us to do in our lives. We have the law of God, but if I don't like it, somehow I'll figure out how to justify myself even though I don't obey it. And that's what religions do, and that's what we as individuals sometimes do if we're not careful. Any questions or comments on that?
Is it tradition because they did it so often in verse 6?
No, it's tradition because it was handed down from human beings and became a part of their ritual or a part of what they always did. But it's specifically tradition because it's just been handed down. Did I miss your question? Or
I'm just trying what Jesus is saying, what their tradition is in dishonoring their parents. That tradition or teaching, what seems to just be so prevalent,
sure,
among
was.
Them,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
that teaching has now become tradition. I don't know if I'm explaining my question very well.
I think, just from the definition of the word, that you would technically say it was tradition first and foremost because it was handed down. Even though, yes, it's adopted by a broad span of people, but it's primarily tradition because it's handed down. That's what the word actually means.
This is what they would teach people to do.
To do, yeah.
Dedicate everything to God. That's what you're supposed to do.
If you want to, well, not necessarily that's what you're supposed to do. But
that's how you get out of it.
That's how you get out of responsibility.
That's the loophole.
That's the loophole. Okay. That's right. It's just like they would teach that on the Sabbath day you could not travel more than about 7/8 of a mile. Now, you're going to have a hard time finding that in the Old Testament, isn't there? But for the Pharisees to try to get around that, they would go out 7/8 of a mile toward the place wherever they wanted to travel that was further than a mile, and they would set up a little tent and put some water and some bread in it, and so that on Sabbath, if they had to get somewhere, they'd travel to that little lean-to that they'd made and drink some water and eat some bread and say, this is my house, I can travel 7/8 more of a mile.
Oh, my word.
And they would station those things out to be able to go wherever they wanted to go. So there was a lot of things they did to offer themselves loopholes, and those were just, of course, made
up. That's what Mark said, and many things like these.
And many things like these you do. That's exactly right. Yeah. Any other questions, comments? All right, so verse 10, and he called the people to him and said to them. All right, so here's the Pharisees teaching, and now Jesus is going to turn to the people, and he's going to explain the truth and where they have, those Pharisees have really missed it. Now, by the way, anybody know how the people saw the Pharisees? What was the people's opinion of the Pharisees?
They were really religious. They looked up to
them. Yeah, they looked up to them.
And they feared them.
That's right.
About, if they went against them, they feared them.
Kicked out of the synagogue. Yeah. And that would be a major change in your life. So yes, they respected them. They feared them. They listened to them. I mean, after all, if you're a Jew in that day, there's a good chance you can't read or write. Who are you going to listen to? Who's going to tell you what the law says? You can listen to reading that does it on the Sabbath, but then you're going to listen to them give exhortations about this, and they're going to add all their stuff in. So the Pharisees were good at preaching, and they would preach about what these things in the Bible meant, and they'd twist it to fit their own desires. And in fact, Jesus in Matthew 24 says they would lay heavy burdens on the people as far as, oh, here's what you have to do, and here's the law and all of this, and here's more laws, and here's more laws, and they would burden them down. But when came to the Pharisee doing them, Jesus said you wouldn't lift it with your little finger, which is illustrated by how they'd keep that Sabbath travel and stuff. They had a little way to get around it. So that was their deal. All right, so teaching the people, verse 10, and he called the people to him and said, hear and understand, it is not what goes into the mouth that defiles a person, but what comes out of the mouth, this defiles a person. Then the disciples came and said to him, do you know that the Pharisees were offended when they heard this saying? Tell me about that right there. What do you notice this right there with those words? Just the way the disciples are looking at it.
Sort of whispered in his ear. Don't you know you're making trouble?
Don't you know what you just did? Why, these are the Pharisees. You just don't go walking around doing that in public and embarrassing them. And boy, they're super offended. Is that really what you wanted to do? It's kind of funny. And so you can see the respect, as you guys said, you can see the respect that they had and stuff like this. Well, I just can't believe you did that. Jesus, do you know that? Like Jesus didn't know it. I think I caught that one.
Like they didn't know that Jesus didn't care.
Yeah, that's right. They're going to know now because his answer is priceless. I have a little bit of the rebellion Jesus has in him. I don't know. There may be a lot of it. So in verse 15, he answered, every plant that my heavenly Father has not planted will be rooted up. Let them alone. They are blind guides. And if the blind lead the blind, both will fall into the pit. Now, he doesn't say, well, why don't you go see if you can win them over? Why don't you go see? Jesus had been there and done that. He had tried. Nope. Let them alone. They're blind guides. And they're going, whoever follows them are going to fall in the pit with them. So just leave them alone. Offended? Well, let me see. The Heavenly Father is going to root up every plant that he didn't plant. Those are strong words. Now, you put that in the big picture view. You have a huge, major religion. The Jewish religion. Huge. It is pervasive in the whole culture. It is the whole nation following it. And Jews all over the Roman Empire following this. And Jesus says, it's all wrong. Now, if you're a Jew, how hard is that to accept?
Very hard.
Very hard. It's hard for all of us when we have grown up in a particular way to be honest enough that when we read the text, we're going to take what it says regardless of what we've been taught or what the majority believe or what anybody else says. If it's in the text, we're going to follow God, not man. This is an amazing counter-cultural statement that Jesus makes. We're not going to compromise with them. We're not going to somehow try to make some kind of friends with, so that we can kind of just get along here. Leave them alone. They're blind leaders of the blind. They're both going to fall in the ditch. And Jesus went about in his teaching dismantling the entire Jewish system because they had so perverted what God's law was. That is our calling. Ladies and gentlemen, that is our calling, to stick with what God says, because there aren't many who will do it, and we need to do it. Period.
That's and God only has to do it. He just has to say it one time.
That's right. That's right. Even though he said it tons of times, he only needs to say it once. Just like us parents. I don't need to tell you a jillion times. Telling you once ought to be enough. God's merciful enough that he tells us all kinds of times how he thinks, how things ought to be. And the question is, will we follow it? Yeah, I've always thought that statement by Jesus, that reply when the disciples said, you've offended them, is wow. Okay, there you go. So, verse 15, Peter then responds. Peter said to him, explain the parable to us. Okay, so the parable would be referring to what he just said. It's not what goes into the mouth that defiles a person, but what comes out of the mouth that defiles a person. So would you explain that? Now, that sounds pretty plain to us, doesn't it? But why did Peter not understand it? That's what's odd. Why, Peter, why didn't you understand that? Anybody got a good answer?
Because thinking about the Acts, he had this vision of what was clean and unclean.
Well, that's later, though.
Yeah, still.
He still had the same problem then, didn't he?
Right.
That's exactly right. Way over in Acts 10, he's going to have the same problem, trying to understand this principle. That's right. That comes back, then, from the book of Leviticus. Peter had bought in to a lot of the things the Pharisees had taught as far as uncleanness is concerned. And in the book of Leviticus, certainly there was such a thing as being unclean. You touched a dead animal, you were unclean till evening and then needed to wash, etc. If you touched somebody who was leprous or whatever, you would have to do the same thing. You'd be unclean. In fact, there was a ton of things you could be unclean for, and you had to go through that thing. And so Jesus is like, well, wait a minute. In Leviticus, if I'm thinking just like, pointed out, if I'm thinking about food, I know I can't eat bacon if I'm a Jew, and so that would go into my mouth, and that sounds like that would defile me. So what are you actually saying, Jesus? So you can see why he would be confused. All right, Jesus gives an amazing answer. Verse 16, he said, are you also still without understanding? It's like, you too? You don't get this? Do you not see that whatever goes into the mouth passes into the stomach and is expelled? But what comes out of the mouth proceeds from the heart, and this defiles a person. For out of the heart come evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false witness, slander. These are what defile a person, but to eat with unwashed hands does not defile anyone. Of course, the law never said you had to do that fancy washing. Never said that touching something that you were unaware of that was unclean was somehow going to make you unclean. You didn't have to worry about it, or you didn't have to worry about what you were going to eat with it. That was never the part. So, how did Jesus correct or explain, maybe is a better word, explain Leviticus and not becoming ritualistically unclean by his words? How did his words explain it?
What goes into the body will come out in a natural way, but what comes out of the body when the words... Like it says, it comes from the heart. That's what matters.
Yeah.
It's like that sticks and stones.
Right. So Leviticus was really just teaching a deeper issue. God was not saying that in Leviticus, if you ate bacon or anything from a pig or an animal that was unclean, that somehow that was a moral issue to make you morally unclean before God. That was a picture of what he was showing and going to show later on, that the true uncleanness came out of your heart, came out of who you are and how you live, not by a simple act of touching a catfish or some other unclean animal. That was not the issue. Okay. So now I know more about Leviticus. Mark's account of this section actually says, thus making all foods clean. In other words, none of that was actually literally something immoral, but God was teaching the principle of how easy it is to be unclean, and now Jesus explains what that uncleanness really comes from, not from touching something, not from what you eat, but actually from that which is immoral coming out of your heart and practicing. Question? Yeah.
So you're saying the physical laws were to illustrate or teach them that their hearts needed to be clean before God when they came.
That's exactly right. Just like an animal sacrifice was to teach them something bigger than just whacking a lamb. It was to teach them that they are to be the sacrifice to God, and that eventually there would be a perfect sacrifice in Jesus. There were deeper issues than all those things. And so we know that. You know, we're not guessing here, by the way. Hebrews 10 verse 1 tells us that the law of Moses was a shadow of the good things to come, not the reality of those things. So this is where sometimes people, they read the Old Testament, read the New Testament, and say, there's contradictions in the Bible. No. One is a shadow of what is real, and the shadow is going to look different than the reality. So when we read the New Testament, we're seeing the true meaning of what God was foreshadowing in the Old Testament. Okay, makes sense? Any questions? All right. So, verse 21 then. Verse 21. And Jesus went away from there and withdrew to the district of Tyre and Sidon. And behold, a Canaanite woman from that region came out and was crying, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David. My daughter is severely oppressed by a demon." All right, let's stop right there so we can see the scene. What did Jesus just do? He pronounced things that were under the Jewish system unclean, he pronounced them clean. He showed that no longer was there to be this ritualistic differentiation between clean and unclean. What was it that Peter learned when, in Acts 10, God told him to rise, kill, and eat?
That
It's okay to associate with both the Jew and the Gentile.
The Jew and Gentile were to be accepted together. The Gentiles were to be accepted in. That it wasn't just the animals, that all things are clean now. People are to be accepted, and Jews are no longer to make a differentiation like that. Now, this is what Jesus is doing. As soon as he teaches that, guess where he does what he does? Verse 21 says, he withdrew. He withdrew from what? He withdrew from Israel. Where'd he go? Tyre and Sidon. What's Tyre and Sidon filled with?
Gentiles.
Not just any Gentiles, wicked Gentiles. Tyre and Sidon were known in Ezekiel and in Isaiah as nations that God cursed. They are cursed nations because of their sinfulness. And now Jesus turns to them to offer them mercy, and actually withdraws from a nation that is filled with traditions of men and worship in vain. Now, an interesting contrast. See, when you're reading the gospel accounts, always pay attention to what's connected to these events, and you'll see much bigger pictures and much greater lessons.
Barry Tyre and Sidon was, they was in direct contact with the world.
Oh, yeah.
All the filth and stuff.
They were filled with the typical things that the worldly sinful people would be filled with. Notice what kind of woman it is. Canaanite. What do you think of in the Old Testament when you think of Canaanites? Cursed people. It's the Canaanites that God told Israel to wipe out, man, woman, and child. They didn't. And here's a descendant of those cursed people. Wow. How interesting. Now, tell me one more thing. What did this woman call Jesus?
First Lord.
Son of David, first off. Yeah, and Lord. What's Son of David imply?
Old Testament.
Pardon?
She knew some Old
Testament. She certainly knew some Old Testament. All right. What are you calling Jesus if you say he's the Son of David?
King.
King and Messiah. That's exactly right. He's the King and Messiah. So here is a cursed Canaanite woman who sees him as Lord, King, and Messiah. Try that on, Jewish nation. No. Not the nation as a whole. They rejected him as king. They rejected him as Messiah. They rejected him as Lord. They killed him. They crucified him. Who's Jesus showing now in Matthew's account, which is written to Jews? You see the warning he's giving them? What an incident. He condemns the nation for their religious traditions, that they violated God's commandment. And now, in contrast, he moves to a Gentile area and he actually is confronted by a cursed Canaanite woman, as the Jews would have looked at it, and he gives her mercy. So, quite a picture.
Well, her response is really...
Oh, yeah. So, let's see that. Let's see it. Verse 23. But he did not answer her a word. It's like, here's this woman crying out to him, and he ignores her. He just ignores her. That's a little weird to us. And his disciples came and begged him, saying, send her away, for she is crying out after us. You can just imagine, this woman will not shut up. She just keeps on. And the disciples are going, would you please? Now, the disciples could be saying, heal her, do what she wants or whatever so that she'll leave. They may not be saying, will you just get rid of her? I mean, obviously, telling her to go away probably isn't going to get rid of her. She's pretty persistent, isn't she? So the disciples said, please do something. Verse 24. He answered, so he finally talks to her. I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. But she came and knelt before him, saying, Lord, help me. And he answered, it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. Who are the children?
Israel.
Who are the dogs?
Canaanites.
Gentiles. Exactly. She knows full well how Jews would refer to Gentiles. And so Jesus just lays it out. Now, if you're the woman, now what are you going to do? Call him a jerk and walk away?
She wasn't offended, was she?
Wasn't offended.
She may have been, but she just wanted help.
And she said, yes, Lord, yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table. And Jesus answered her, O woman, great is your faith. Be it done to you as you desire. And her daughter was healed instantly. What's Matthew showing? What's Matthew just showed the Jews who are reading this book?
And it's by faith, and that God doesn't discern between different groups of people. It's the faith that matters in this case.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So showed that God is not looking for the individual in a particular race or people or nationality, but he accepts everyone by faith. Also, what would that be? Think of the contrast from the previous section. What's that teaching?
She humbled herself.
Yes.
She put her daughter's welfare first.
She completely humbles herself. She says, you know what? I was thinking about this as I was studying it this afternoon. Who among us in the presence of Jesus wouldn't say, I am a dog. Just give me the crumbs. Have mercy. Absolutely.
All of us.
Those who come to Jesus aren't people who come with pride, who come with, boy, I'm really important. She accepts that position. And really, at first you think of it as an offensive thing. But the longer you think about it, the more you think, wait a minute, all of us should be answering it that way. We're just grateful for the mercy that God would give us because we really aren't worth any more than a dog from what our lives have been and how we've sinned in His sight. So it's quite a moving statement, I think, and Him saying what great faith. Now, the last time you heard that was back in Matthew 8 with the centurion, also a Gentile. He does not say that to Jewish people. And that's what Matthew shows, that contrast. Really important.
I was just going to say, so many times we don't have the desire that this woman had.
Yeah.
And when God says, ask and ye shall receive, knock and so on, that's telling us you don't ask one time.
Yeah.
You ask and ask.
How bad do you want it?
That's right.
That's right. How bad do you want God? How bad do you want the mercy of God? How bad do you want the knowledge of God? You're a strong seeker. You're not just somebody casually going, oh, well, not that important. Great picture. Anybody else? Any kind of comments?
I don't know. It still seems so cruel.
What?
It's just, I just can't even read this one without thinking, how could he do this? I mean, every time I read it, I still think,
how could he say that?
Behave that way. Yeah.
Yeah. Because he's trying to draw out of her the beauty of her own person, the beauty of her humility, the beauty of her dependence, and that's the person that is exalted in God's sight. And he's showing it at all. He's showing her up to all of us. This is who he's looking for. This kind of person. And it's really quite a wonderful, wonderful picture of what God wants us to become. Really, you know, Luke's account is going to show those kinds of pictures over and again, just like the sinful woman who comes into the house of Simon the Pharisee. You know, you have that same contrast. Simon the Pharisee is a good example of the pride of Israel. The sinful woman is an example of a person who recognizes the severity of her sin and the need for mercy. And that's who he wants us to see. He wants us to see that very thing.
Seems like he's also, his closest disciples are the only ones who saw this at this point.
Yeah.
That he's more interested in trying to teach them.
Sure. Yeah.
Than the Pharisees and the previous.
Sure.
That he just sort of wrote off.
Yeah, he's teaching
from their heart.
Yeah, because the disciples, it's a good point, because the disciples are going to see the contrast, aren't they, between the Pharisees they just dealt with and this particular woman. And it's quite a picture.
Also the contrast between this woman and Peter.
There you go.
In chapter 14, O ye of little faith.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, yeah. Chapter 14, the little faith, and here's the great faith. Good, good point. That is great.
Barry, am I reading this correctly that he doesn't really answer her until verse 28. His answers are going to the disciples. Even though she's talking to him, he's addressing his disciples.
Kind of is, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, that's until verse 28. I thought about that too, that it almost seems like he's discussing with his disciples while she's listening in, isn't it?
He's just ignoring her.
Yeah, just kind of still ignoring her. And she finally interjects, you know, and says, but...
Yes.
I'm happy, you know. I can be the dogs under the table eating the crumbs. That's fine.
Barry, I think so many times what we need to understand, we're in the era after the resurrection, and we can see the end right now from where we are. But they couldn't. But they will, if that makes sense.
No, I'm not following you.
They
knew of a resurrection too.
Right, but I'm not just talking about the resurrection. But they don't have book, chapter, and verse. I mean,
yeah, this is all just being unveiled to them.
And so what? Yeah. We're at the end, looking back.
Yeah.
They're
in the beginning, trying to figure it out.
Exactly.
Yeah. Good point. Yeah. Yeah, I understand. I understand. Okay, so then verse 29. Jesus went on from there and walked beside the Sea of Galilee, and he went up on the mountain and sat down there. Now, I've got to fill in one little thing here for you. This, according to Mark's account, is in Decapolis, which is on the east side of the Sea of Galilee and is a predominantly Gentile area. So this is going to add in, this is just going to another example of Jesus hanging out in Gentile areas, not in Jewish areas. All right, so you can see another interesting connection. And he went up on the mountain and sat down there, and great crowds came to him, bringing with them the lame, the blind, the crippled, the mute, and many others, and they put them at his feet, and he healed them. So that the crowd wondered when they saw the mute speaking, the crippled healthy, the lame walking, and the blind seeing, and they glorified the God of Israel. Notice how that's said? They glorify the God of Israel. So here's outsiders seeing these miracles, and they glorify the God of Israel. Knowing that they, you know, are on the outside. That's how they would have looked at it. Verse 32, this connects. Then Jesus called his disciples to him and said, I have compassion on the crowd because they have been with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. And I am unwilling to send them away hungry lest they faint on the way. Does this remind you of a previous incident? Feeding of the 5,000, which was Jewish. So the question arises, as to why would Jesus do two almost identical miracles? Why would now he do a miracle that is just, and when we read down through it, you're going to say, it is just identical. The only difference maybe is a little bit is the difference in the kind of baskets they carry. They collected the leftovers. So everything is the same.
Deja vu.
Deja vu. So we want to ask the question, why in all these accounts do you see both miracles shown? It's not like you got to do it a second time. So that's what we want to discover. Julie.
Showing the Gentiles that he's going to feed them spiritually as well as.
That's exactly right. Just bingo. It's just right there. Why would Matthew show a duplicate miracle? Because it's a different group, and this group is Gentile, and now he's showing he's giving them equal standing. They can be accepted just like the Jews. They can be fed just like the Jews. He's the bread of life. As John 6 would say, he's the bread of life for them, just like he's the bread of life for the Jews. Wow. What a great picture. Now watch what happens. I want you to notice that going on in verse 32. I have compassion for the crowd because they've been with me now, how long?
3 days.
In the feeding of the 5,000, he fed them after how long?
One day.
Hadn't even been a night. One day. These have stuck with him 3 days in the wilderness. Wow. That can be getting hungry. But they won't leave him. They stick with him. They're loving it. They're eating it up. All right? And he says, I have nothing to eat. They have nothing to eat. And I am unwilling to send them away hungry, lest they faint in the way. Verse 33, and the disciples said to him, where are we to get enough bread in such a desolate place to feed so great a crowd? Same old crazy response. The disciples are faithless, still not getting it, even though they witnessed it before. Verse 34, and Jesus said to them, how many loaves do you have? Same question, not asking you what you can do, asking you what you have. We can do anything with what you have. They said 7 and a few small fish, and directing the crowd to sit down on the ground, he took the 7 loaves and the fish, and having given thanks, he broke them and gave them to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to the crowds. Same exact serving going on. And they all ate and were satisfied. Older versions ate and were filled. What happens when the Lord feeds you? You will be satisfied. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they should be satisfied. They should be filled. Sermon on the Mount. And they took up 7 baskets full of the broken pieces left over. Those who ate were 4,000 men besides women and children. And after sending away the crowds, he got in the boat and went to the region of Magadan or Magdala, depending on your version. That was on the Jewish side of the sea going over to the western side. So there you are. You can see this chapter of how the unit goes. The denouncing and condemnation of the Jews and what they have done to God's religion and God's laws, and then the acceptance of the Gentiles and bringing them in and showing that Jesus is the bread of life for them and healing them, indicating that he will heal them spiritually. If you're a Jew, that punches you in the nose if you don't obey and you don't listen. And if you're a Gentile, you're rejoicing with great joy. Quite a scene, huh? Hopefully that gives you a picture of that chapter you haven't seen before. I know it is new to me as well. It is beautiful. All righty. Any other comments or questions?
Nothing. One thing that stands out kind of is that because there's such a small, he's got all these crowds, everybody's hungry, so it's really an overwhelming quantity there. But then he's like, it seems on both, he has very little to start with. So if you're sitting there, say, ooh, how's seven loaves of bread? How's going to feed all these people? And that's what we do all the time. I know I do. You worry, oh my gosh, how am I going to pay the bills? How am I going to do this?
Yeah.
And if you just sit and then you really, it's very hard to say, I know God's going to provide it because it's so small. Is he going to get it?
Yes.
And I think it's like kind of really just you know, shows that it doesn't matter what it looks like and how small is it or whatnot. Don't worry about it. God's going to multiply it or do with it as, you know, much or little what he sees fit. So
I think that's a great point. And not only to apply it to physical needs, but to apply it to our own efforts.
Yeah.
Because our own efforts are nothing, but he can multiply it. And that's, I think, a big message we ought to see there. Very, very good. Anything else? Any other comments or questions?
Do you think that the Jews would have read their feeding of the 5,000 and then read the Gentiles and been like, oh,
sure,
we reacted this way, but the Gentiles reacted this way?
Absolutely. It would have been very glaring. And this is the reason Matthew records it. That's exactly right. You know, we always got to remember that, you know, this is a Jew writing to the Jews. Excuse me, I didn't turn this off. This is a Jew writing to the Jews about Jesus, trying to convert them to Jesus. And so these are very, very well placed, and those pictures are there for them to see, and there's no doubt they'd see it. Exactly right. He's punched them in the face on Gentiles over and over again throughout this whole thing.
I was going to just, you know, really kind of Jesus has shown us by these comparisons. It's almost like, you know, it's much easier to get somebody to believe in you, to convert, or to, who comes with really very little that's already there. It's much harder to convince people who think they know everything and they have already come with all these traditions, like you said there, and then, you know, to get them to believe and have faith. The others are just going to come empty-handed, so to speak, and they're like ready to receive, you know, whereas the Jews, in this case, they rejected, you know, and it's probably a lot easier to go to a prison maybe and convert people who are, or get someone to believe in God who's got very little going on, whereas, you know, you go to even a fancy church and say, this is a mind, they're not... you know, they're not willing to listen because they're so hunkered down into their doctrine, you know. And that was
in fact Jesus' continued experience. The most religious of the day were the most stubborn, and the most sinful were the ones who were more responsive. That's because they recognized their need. That's right, and that's the way we all need to be. I don't care. How long we've studied the Bible, how long we've done it, we need to always recognize every single day that we are in great need for His mercy. You don't ever come to a day where you go, let me dial up God and say, you know, I really don't need your grace today. You can take a vacation. You know, this is not the way we need to be looking at this.
And that's why He told His disciples, leave the Pharisees alone.
Yeah, leave them alone.
He knows their heart. He knows
that. You're not going to get anywhere with them. That's exactly right. Wasting your time. All right, very good. That's a good study.